an analysis of the Paris terrorist attacks, some tools for you to use when you're engaged on the question of so-called religious extremism.
Terrorist acts since 1970, something like 43% of all the casualties inflicted have been inflicted by those acting in the name of radical Islam. Those that we would attribute to Christian extremism, something like 2%. And when you consider that Christianity is the world's largest religion.
On the news portion, another prominent pro-life MP announces plans to retire. Trinity Western's law school graduates will be allowed to work in New Brunswick. The CBC's caught out on another major hatchet job on pro-lifers. And we take a look back at some of the top social policy stories of 2014.
And now, Lighthouse News. Lighthouse News is a presentation of ARPA, the Association for Reform Political Action. Here's your host, Al Sebring.
Pro-lifers are losing another high-profile advocate in Canada's Parliament. Winnipeg MP Rod Brunage is the long-serving chair of the Parliamentary Pro-Life Caucus. He issued a statement early this month saying he wouldn't be running again in this fall's election, that the loss of a close family member over the Christmas holidays led to his decision to spend more time at home. He said he was reminded of how precious each moment is with his children. Brunage isn't the first member of that pro-life caucus to announce his retirement. Others include Diana Blonsey, Russ Hebert, Brian Storseth, Lamar Payne, and, of course, Maurice Vellacott. Lawrence Tote, the MP for another Winnipeg area riding, Elmwood Transcona, is also part of the caucus. He says these people will be missed, but it doesn't spell the end of pro-life advocacy on Parliament Hill.
Obviously, we'll miss leadership. People like Rod and Morris have done great work. Those are big shoes to fill, but there's lots of people that are prepared to stand up and do what's necessary. And, you know, I think we just got to continue working forward with the people of Canada. We got to change our hearts and minds here, and we need to have people that are willing to make it a situation where being a politician who's pro-life is seen as actually a very positive attribute, which isn't seen by a lot of people, but, you know, there's a certain amount of trepidation out there. I believe there's a lot of members of Parliament that maybe don't hold strong enough views, but may well be pro-life. But there's that stigma and that fear, a little bit of coming out on it. And I just think as we change the hearts and minds and this Canadian public becomes much more educated and we're seeing that change, I think we're seeing a shift in that direction.
As to what the pro-life caucus will look like after the next election, Tote is hoping the abortion issue will continue to attract interest from politicians across the political spectrum.
I think there will be members in the Liberal side that will continue to hold their particular point of view. Obviously, their leader has said they're not welcome, so that saddens me that we're not allowed to have different points of view within a caucus. But I don't see it becoming a partisan affair. I think it really is a, you know, matter of the heart and a matter of conscience that we need to continue bringing forward. So if there's one party that has more members that stand in that way, that may well be the case, but I don't see it as a partisan issue.
Right now, most of the pro-life caucus is drawn from the Conservative Party. Another development of the Trinity Western Law School case, the Law Society of New Brunswick has upheld the accreditation of TWU's proposed law school. The decision, a reaffirmation of what the society had said last year. A group of lawyers had tried to get the society there to overturn its earlier approval, similar to what happened in BC late last year. But it didn't happen this time. Guy Safford speaks for Trinity Western.
We think it represents a fair and appropriate application of the laws of Canada. We're happy that they've weighed the issues and come to this conclusion in our favor.
Right now, there's four other jurisdictions that say they will recognize the school's graduates if it's ever accredited. Alberta, Saskatchewan, PEI, and the Yukon have all said yes. But BC and Nova Scotia have reversed themselves. In Nova Scotia, that case has become the subject of a legal challenge. ARPA's lawyer, Andre Schutten, was before the Nova Scotia Supreme Court in Halifax in late December.
The basic argument that ARPA put forward was that the state must respect equality of all people in Canada on the basis of religion. They can't discriminate against certain groups. What Nova Scotia's Barrister Society did was that they said that if you belong to a Christian community that holds its members to a certain standard of biblical holiness, then you do not have equal access to the practice of law in that province. And we argued that that violates Section 15 of the Charter, the equality rights laid out there, that everyone has the right to equal treatment and benefit of the law, regardless of, among other things, their religious beliefs.
Schutten says the way the judge was asking questions during the proceedings might give us a hint into the way the court could be leaning.
It's bad form for lawyers to try to predict what the outcome will be, but I think that I can say that the judge in this case had less questions for us than he did for the Barrister Society. It seems to me that our arguments were palatable, they were understandable, they were clear, they were straightforward. and that the arguments from the Barrister Society were more convoluted. They were more difficult to follow. And my opinion, my legal opinion, is simply because they weren't following the law. They were trying to create new law or change the law, but they definitely weren't following the law. And I think that's natural then that the judge would have a whole lot more questions for them.
Decision is expected by the end of February. Something else happened over the Christmas break, too, that you might not have heard about. The CBC got caught on another major attempted hatchet job on the pro-life cause. 2 weeks before Christmas, the network came out with a story that was headlined, "Anti-Abortion Protest Bent Rules on Parliament Hill." It was a piece on ARPA's flag display that happened on the Hill back in early October. A display, incidentally, which the CBC completely ignored while it was happening. And the problem is, the December story was completely wrong. Mike Schutten, with ARPA's pro-life arm, We Need a Law, says no rules were bent or broken at all.
We followed all the rules. We had subsequent conversations with them on the day that they made this their top news story and said, look, this is the process we went through. This is the permission we got. I had one conversation with a CBC reporter later that day, and she said, well, so, in your opinion, were the rules bent? I'm like, no, they weren't. We followed them to a T. Well, what do you say to the story then? I said to her, I said, well, you're going to have to talk to the parliamentary committee that gave us permission to do this, because according to the rules outlined for us, we followed them.
Schutten admits the initial application to stage the event was turned down, but when organizers asked for some clarification, it was allowed to proceed. The only difference was a slight move in the venue from the main lawns at Parliament Hill to the grass adjacent to Wellington Avenue. But he says no rules were broken or even bent.
This is how things work in a democracy. When someone says no, you ask for clarification. You say, is there any compromise here? Is there any way we can still conduct our event according to the rules? And there was.
The most frustrating thing? Even though the CBC was made aware of the facts of the story, no clarification or retraction was ever issued. And with the changing of the calendar to a new year, it seems appropriate to look back at 2014. The Institute of Marriage and Family Canada did that with a news release entitled The Top 5 Social Policy Stories of 2014. The Institute's Andrea Morozik says one story stood out head and shoulders above the rest.
Well, definitely a highlight is the family income splitting. The introduction of that is a step in the right direction, and we are happy to see that progress being made. Essentially, it involved spouses being allowed to share their income on their tax form the way they do already in real life, so that if there's a higher earning spouse, some of their income can be transferred to the lower earning spouse, and then that decreases the tax burden for that family.
Other highlights, the group pointed to Canada's new prostitution law, the ongoing debate over euthanasia in Parliament, the courts, and the Quebec National Assembly, as well as several studies they did showing the failings of mandatory all-day kindergarten and the economic advantages of marriage. We've got a link to that news release on our website. Back with more after this.
The ARPA Canada Tour has three remaining stops. Canada in 2020, still a land glorious and free, will be presented in Winnipeg on January 19th at Redeemer Canadian Reformed Church. The tour will then do two stops in the Lower Mainland on Tuesday, January 20th at Yarrow Canadian Reformed Church in Chilliwack, and Wednesday, January 21st, at the Langley Canadian Reformed Church. All events will be at 7:30 p.m. Visit our Facebook page or arpacanada.ca for event details and directions.
And we're back on the program. On January 7th, three gunmen burst into the offices of a French satirical newspaper, Charlie Hebdo. When the attack was over, a dozen people were dead. Most of the victims worked at the paper, which was famous for its disrespect and mockery of all things, both religious and secular. Their cartoons mocked Christians, Jews, Hindus, government officials, actors, pretty much everybody. But what prompted the attack was their mocking of Islam. Cartoons, some of them egregiously irreverent, of the Prophet Muhammad. The attack prompted a worldwide outcry about freedom of speech, but it's also renewed the discussion about the intersection between religious views, blasphemy, and, for a lack of a better description, political realities. On the line with me today from the Ezra Institute in Toronto is Dr. Scott Masson. He deals a lot in cultural apologetics. First of all, Dr. Mastin, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you very much. Great to be with you this morning.
So, first of all, just give me your general take on what happened in Paris. I mean, we've had the attack in Ottawa. We had other sort of what are being called lone wolf attacks in various places. But this one seems to have hit a nerve because it was very clearly organized and orchestrated. It wasn't just one lone guy.
No, that's correct. I mean, the reports that I have watched, listened to, and read about have all stated that these were professionals. They knew exactly what they were doing. They knew what to do and how to go about it. The executions were professionally done, etc. And they had to execute two policemen as well who were there to guard them. So they clearly knew what they were doing, and then they had an escape route planned. It wasn't a suicide attack. So yeah, it's extraordinary and clearly much planned for. And on the back of what happened in Ottawa, clearly we're seeing a pattern here, which has been recognized elsewhere as well. So I don't know if you saw this or not, but I think his name is Anjem Chowdhury, the London cleric or imam, has basically stated that this is exactly what should be expected for those that malign the name of the Prophet Muhammad. This is a blasphemous act to do so, he said so, and the penalty for that in his understanding of Islam is death. So there you go. He said that's the way it goes, and this was just published in the USA Today. So very interesting that such a big newspaper has now published an extremist Muslim cleric, and really it contradicts what the popular view presented of Islam by the public authorities, like the President of the United States, who's tried to keep away from that connection with Islam.
Dr. Al Mohler had an op-ed the day after this happened, and he talked about the fact that whether we like it or not, we are actually engaged in a clash of religious worldviews, that at root, this is a dispute about religion.
Yes, it is. There's no doubt about that. I mean, Islam is a supremacist religion. It believes that there are basically two cultures in the world. There's that of Islam itself, and then there's that of the rest of the world. So there's the House of Islam, the Dar al-Islam, and then there's the House of War, Dar al-Harb, and that's the portion of Islam that's not yet been brought under Sharia law, and eventually will be. We are effectively apostate Muslims if we're not Muslims. And so, yes, there is a war going on between those of the House of Islam and the rest of the world. That's how they see it. And so it doesn't matter if their opponents don't see it that way. They don't have to agree what's going on that front. So I think that increasingly I'm afraid that the posture of neutrality, which we've tried to feign others to be interested in the rest of the world, they're just not going to buy. We're seeing signs in the public sphere now that there's a growing acceptance of that, although we're not quite there yet, it seems to me.
So here's what people are running into. I've seen it on social media. I've had people actually say it to my face. The notion that religion is somehow bound up in this in a generic sense. And what you're hearing is, you know what, this is what happens when people get too fanatic about their faith. Really, Christians are no different from Muslims. Religion, by its very nature, inevitably leads to this kind of extremism if you take it too seriously. How do people respond to that kind of critique? Because we're hearing it all over the place now.
Well, I mean, again, that is the posture of neutrality speaking to some extent. And it's contradicted simply by the facts on the ground, really. I mean, the terrorist acts since 1970, something like 43% of all the casualties inflicted have been inflicted by those acting in the name of radical Islam. 30%, 31% by the communists, etc. Those that we would attribute to Christian extremism, something like 2%. I mean, when you consider that Christianity is the world's largest religion, I think the facts belie even that, if we're just going to appeal to that. But it also fails to differentiate between the actual differences between the religions. And on this front, it's quite clear that for Christians, their understanding of Christian conviction directly contradicts the need to, you know, avenge the name of the Lord Jesus Christ whenever his name is contradicted and blasphemed, quite frankly. Christ himself suffered blasphemy and deterred the church from avenging him. You know, he told Peter to put his sword away when he sought to avenge that sort of act against him immediately. And Christians historically have never, or rarely at any rate, sought to persecute blasphemers in the way that we see the Muslims understand that to be. I mean, blasphemy for a Muslim is simply portraying Muhammad, never mind in an ill light, but simply portraying him at all, is considered to be a capital offense. So that equation between Christianity and Islam is based on pure ignorance. I think most reasonable people are now recognizing that there really can be no comparison there between what happens in Islam and what happens in Christianity, or for that matter, for most other religions.
So it's just it's a matter of moral equivalence that we can't draw.
Quite frankly, that's correct. And it's an attempt to come from the postulate of neutrality, that, you know, the best worldview is the secular materialist worldview of our contemporaries, and that avoids the religious extremism of all religions, etc. It's their excuse for refusing really to investigate for themselves the claims of Jesus Christ and what his lordship would entail for their lives. So it's a way of dismissing that claim, which Jesus does claim supremacy over their lives as well. But it doesn't necessarily work itself out in the same way it does in Islam. In fact, manifestly, it does not.
So here we are. It's January. Not a particularly auspicious start to the new year, and we had the attack in Ottawa not that long ago. I'm going to ask you to look into your crystal ball and predict a little bit, I guess. Are things going to get worse before they get better?
I'm afraid that that is the case. I would like to think otherwise, but I think I would be very naive to do so. There's been a clear and obvious immigration of Muslim radicals into the Western world. There are whole areas, no-go areas around Paris and in areas of London, Luton, the north of England, where Sharia law is now in place, where it's dangerous for the police to go. Same thing in Scandinavia. And we're finding that the freedoms that come from being a citizen of these countries include the freedom to travel. And they're traveling to, again, the areas of the Islamic State and fighting there, and then coming back radicalized with the capabilities of inflicting the same sort of damage in the Western world. And we've seen that again in our own nation's capital, and now happening in Paris. I suspect that it's going to continue. That's been the threat, and the threat is being carried out. I see no reason why that would stop, actually. I do think that the conversation is being moved on, and those that are in power right now and have been trying to present Islam as being a peaceful religion are becoming increasingly incredible. I expect that there will be more attacks, and there will be, as a consequence, a need for the ground to move on this.
Sir, thank you very much. We're out of time.
Thank you.
And just a final note on this, ARPA has developed some policy suggestions on the whole multicultural issue based on an address given by Dr. Cornell Van Damme at an event in Ottawa a few years ago. We're urging you to send those policy suggestions to your Member of Parliament with the Easy Mail feature. You can find the link on the ARPA website.
This has been Lighthouse News, shining the light of biblical truth on today's current events. Production Manager Mark Penninga. Technical Director, Nate Bosher. Questions or feedback? Email info@arpacandidate.ca. Be sure to join us again in 2 weeks for another edition of Lighthouse News.